UK Wine Show, show number 184 for the 27th of November 2009. Jamie Good on respiration and photosynthesis. Good day to you all and welcome to the UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and on this week's show we're talking with Dr. Jamie Good and we're talking about respiration and photosynthesis. I hope you found this journey into the biology of grapevines interesting. Personally, this week's been a pain, quite literally a pain. I tweaked my back the other day and it's been really sore for ages. But sadly, the drugs that the doctor put me on, such as Valium, clash with alcohol. And so it's been a choice of back spasms or nice wine. Well, let's just say I had a cracking Sainsbury's, taste the difference shabbily this week. I picked it up along with a few other bottles when Sainsbury's had that 25% off, which I mentioned on the show a couple of weeks ago. Actually, I got the recommendation from Janice Robinson and her Purple Pages, so cheers to her for that. It was a cracking Chablis and under £10. Well, actually, it's under £9, to be honest. And when you take 25% off, I was very happy with it as a price. I find a lot of Chablis under £10 or even £10 are pretty thin, pretty acidic, and they smell of old socks, not an enjoyable drink. So hats off to Janice for spotting that one. Obviously, it didn't help my back pain too much, but half a bottle of Chablis seemed to relax me enough, so it did seem to help. It's actually been quite hard with a bit of back pain. I did a presentation at Bosworth Hall. It's one of our one-day wine courses, and just up near Birmingham. Luckily, I had Sam, who's one of our assistants. Well, she runs tastings for us, but she assisted me at Bosworth Hall. So I had 6 hours driving in a car with a crook back, followed by 6 hours standing up presenting, which could have been really hard, but it seemed to go pretty well. The bit of an ad break, I wanted to mention these because these Bosworth Hall wine tasting courses are really good value. You get 2 nights accommodation as a weekend break and it includes all your meals and our 1 day wine course on the said day. So quite good value at £130 per person. They've got 2 weekends still left, 28th of February and the 12th of March. And I think they'd make a great present and they're incredible value as well. So we normally charge £75 for our 1 day wine course, including lunch, which is 18 wines. Quite good fun, really. We don't sell the tickets to Bosworth Hall, mainly because it involves accommodation and you need to be specially registered and all that sort of stuff. But you can find the link to their website to get them from our website. Just go to selectwinecourses at 3050.co.uk. It's now along the buttons at the top or down the sides and in the text somewhere on the page, on the homepage. You'll find a couple of links either to weekends or 1 day wine course and you should find it in there. While you're there, do think about buying a voucher or a ticket for a loved one on a wine course. We find we sell a lot of these tickets over Christmas, and we sell open-dated vouchers as well for either our one-day wine course or our evening wine tastings. We run the evening wine tastings in London and in Bristol. The one-day wine course runs in London or as a weekend break either in Bosworth Hall, and we have another venue we're using in Liverpool, so do check that out. Now, it's been a bit of a long ad break there, especially at the front. So sorry about that. I never put a plug in for our business. And now that it's come out to Christmas, I thought, wow, slip one in there for you guys. Also, thanks to everybody who's been following me on Twitter. I haven't been Twittering too much because it's been a bit painful sitting down at my desk this week. But thank you for all those who've been following me at Winescriber. I'll give you more information about why I chose that as a Twitter name later on. But before we get into that, we've got our mystery grape variety, which is coming up next, and then we're going to have the news. So let's have our mystery grape variety. As normal, I'm going to give you 2 sets of clues, one now and one after the news. And what I want you to do is work out the grape variety, and then I'll give you the answer at the end of the show. So this week's mystery grape variety. Our mystery variety is a hot climate red variety. Its origins are uncertain, although it probably originated in Spain in Aragon in the north. But it's the same variety as in Sardinia's Canonu, so it could have made its journey there from Spain. Whatever it is, now its largest presence is in France, particularly in the south of Languedoc-Roussillon and southern Rhone. The high-yielding grape survives well in such hot, dry, windy vineyards as a result of its strong wood. It buds early, ripens relatively late, and can achieve quite high sugar levels in regions that afford it a long growing cycle. Its weakness is a lack of colour and low tannins, which is why it's often blended, such as in Rioja. But it's possible to concentrate both these characteristics if yields are kept low. Right, that ends our clue. That we're going to give you the second clue after the news, which is coming up next with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. London's Vinopolis is celebrating its 10th birthday this month, proving itself as one of the world's more successful wine centres. While others have fallen by the wayside, Vinopolis remains standing. Vinopolis, City of Wine, as it's officially known, is located on the south bank of the Thames on a one-hectare site and attracts 600,000 visitors a year. It's had its ups and downs, though, failing to attract sufficient numbers in the early days, but has diversified to offer whisky tastings, Bombay Sapphire Gin, rum and a microbrewery. Last year it launched the Laughter Lounge, a regular comedy night. The venue brings in profits of £1.3 million on an annual turnover of £8 million.
While it's easy to criticise Vinopolis for moving away from its true wine roots, they have managed to survive much better than any other wine centre around the world, so congratulations to them for notching up 10 years. And I do hope they get better and better, although I hope they don't compete too much with us. What's next, Jane?
Well, wine containing an antibiotic, natamycin, has been withdrawn from sale in Germany because while it doesn't pose a threat to humans, they say, it is a banned substance in wine in Europe. The state analytical laboratories in Rhineland-Pfalz have been analysing wines from non-EU countries since the beginning of November, and the five contaminated wines out of 146 analysed were sourced from Argentina. Importers and distributors are now having wines in their portfolios tested by private laboratories, and apparently similar investigations have been initiated in Argentina to establish how the natamycin came to be in the wines.
I've been following the story for weeks now, and none of the main news outlets that I usually follow have mentioned this, so it's interesting. Natamycin is a naturally occurring antifungal agent produced during fermentation of a bacterium, Streptomyces natalensis, commonly found in soils. Natamycin has been used for decades in the food industry to stop fungal outgrowths in dairy products, meats and other foods. While banned in the UK for wine, natamycin is approved for various dairy use. I suppose it's not so much a worry about that it's in the wine, but it is unusual that it stops yeasts from fermenting, so it's probably likely to have been added to the wine after fermentation, which would imply that the Streptomyces natalensis didn't come from the vineyard, but was introduced into the wines after fermentation. Either way, don't worry about it too much. If you eat any fancy cheeses, you've probably had quite a bit of natamycin, so don't get too worried about it. And it's only really strong, high dosages, which will induce vomiting and diarrhea. So I wouldn't worry about that too much. I think this is a case of the wine being banned, not because it is a problem, but because wine in the EU is only allowed to have certain things, and if it's not in that checklist of approved chemicals, then it's banned. It just does seem a bit strange that it's just coming from Argentinian wine, so I wonder what's going on there. What's the last news story, Jane?
Just an update for those of you who have been following the closure of First Quench retailing. This week, the administrators have announced the closure of another 381 stores and more than 1,900 job losses after failing to find buyers. This brings the total job losses to around 3,600 and the store closures to 754. The sale of about 500 shops as going concerns is still a possibility, and KPMG say they're in advanced talks with several interested parties. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out these stories on our website, 3050.co.uk.
Wow. Looks like most of First Quench is not salvageable. It just goes to show that no one is interested in being a high street wine retailer. I did read a particularly brutal assessment of First Quench, which was along the lines of that if you're selling the same wines that are in the supermarket but at higher prices, then you're not a destination store. And if you're not a destination store, who's going to go out of their way when they're doing their shopping to buy wines from you? What I want is a wine store that sells interesting wines, not some big brands. Oh well, less competition for those in the high street who do manage to survive this recession. So hats off to them. Okay, next up we have the spotlight. This week we're looking at reverse osmosis as a way of reducing alcohol. So here's a quick overview of reverse osmosis. Formally, reverse osmosis, as it applies to removing alcohol, is the process of forcing alcohol from a region of high alcohol concentration through a semi-permeable membrane to a region of low alcohol concentration by applying pressure. Sounds pretty straightforward. Functionally, it's rather more simple than the name implies. In normal filtration, wine is pressurized and forced through a membrane that has set holes size, excluding molecules and particles of a particular size. Reverse osmosis is a cross flow where the wine is passed in parallel to the filter. It helps to eliminate clogging of the membrane. The wine is at a pressure, and the pressure forces, in our case, alcohol and water through the pores. The remaining wine is returned to the tank. Then, the alcohol and water can be separated using distillation, with the water added back to the wine if desired. Like the spinning cone method, not all the wine needs to be processed, but typically it's around a quarter of the wine needing to be processed to reduce the alcohol levels. Reverse osmosis can also be used to remove water from must, or that's grape juice, effectively increasing the concentration of all the other components and making the wine more concentrated in flavour. It can also be used to remove flavours from wines such as Brettanomyces, smoke taint, which has happened a bit in Australia and California in the last couple of years, and also to cure some stuck fermentations where acetic acid can get a bit high. Its most common use in the world is in desalination plants for the removal of salt from salty water to make drinking water. If reverse osmosis is simply a cross-flow filter, why such a complicated name? Well, it is the opposite of what's called osmosis, obviously. And let's look at an example using alcohol. When you have a membrane that's full of water and is in a bucket of water, water molecules pass in and out in each direction at exactly the same rate. There's no net flow of water through the membrane. However, now, if one side contains alcohol and the other pure water on the other side, the membrane is still hit by molecules from both sides at the same rate. However, some of the alcohol molecules hitting the membrane will not pass through the membrane because they're too big. So, water molecules pass through the membrane from this side at a slower rate. This will result in a net flow of water to the side with the alcohol in it. Another example of osmosis in wine is yeasts. If a yeast cell is in a super high concentration of sugar, water will flow through this yeast cell to the sugary water, dehydrating the yeast cell and killing it off. And it's the reason why it's so hard to get super sweet wines to ferment, and why they don't start spontaneously fermenting once they've been made, even if there's a bit of stray yeast in the wine still. It's the same reason why they used to salt meat in the old days. Lots of salt means that the yeast will dehydrate as well. Water naturally flows to a solution with alcohol, salt, or sugar, etc. in it. Reverse osmosis is the opposite of this. We are removing alcohol from a water solution, not adding water to it. Okay, that ends this week's spotlight on reverse osmosis. And it's the final part of looking at reducing alcohol in wine for a while. There is a couple more methods of removing alcohol from wine. But next week, we're going to be looking at our monthly poll. And this month's question is this. This Christmas, how will you be celebrating with your work colleagues? Do go to our website, 3050.co.uk, and click on our podcast and have your say. It's on the right-hand side of the page, if I remember correctly. So just have a click on the poll and see what the answers are. But next up, though, we have got our mystery grape, or at least the second clue in our mystery grape. So here's our clue again. Our mystery grape has a tendency to oxidize early, a rustic quality, and an attractive sweetness. However, in irrigated vineyards such as in the New World, the vine may even lose these taste markers. At other extremes, if it's pruned severely, grown on the poorest soils, and the grapes reach full maturity, it can produce rich red wines needing several decades of cellaring, as in some diligent producers in Châteauneuf-du-Pape have shown. It certainly is a multi-purpose grape, and apart from producing dry reds, it's also a grape used much for rosés in France and Spain, and it's also the ingredient in sweet Vendin Natural wines such as Bagnols and Mouri, while Sardinia makes alcoholic red dessert wines from it. Beyond that, it's found growing in Calabria, Sicily, Israel, and both South and North Africa. Do have we ponder that? I'm going to give you the answer after our interview, which is coming up next. Let's have a listen to what Dr. Jamie Good has to say about plant respiration and photosynthesis.
Hi, I'm here with Jamie Good, PhD in plant biology. How are you, Jamie?
Very good, yes.
Excellent. We've been talking a wee bit about lots of different parts of plant biology for the last couple of while, but something I want to get my head around is what happens to a plant as the temperatures change and the plant goes under stress? Because I understand that when things are going well, it's pretty straightforward, but when things go bad, the plant actually responds differently and changes that can create all sorts of interesting effects.
Yes,
to the
absolutely.
Flavor of the wine.
Yeah. Well, you see, plants have to make these calculations. You know, they've got to decide that there's a few factors that they've got to balance out and make a calculation about. And obviously, one of the problems with living on land is that evaporation, especially in a warm climate, the plant has to make sure it doesn't lose too much water.
Yeah.
So the plant has to get a sense of how much water is available and how much water it's losing, and then stop that loss of water if the loss of water is outweighing the benefit of having its stomata, which are the tiny pores that it allows gas exchange through, to close. So what's happening is a plant photosynthesizing. A plant needs to absorb carbon dioxide from the air.
Yeah.
And there isn't much carbon dioxide in the air. A bit more these days than there was. too much damn carbon dioxide in the air. No, there actually is a very low concentration of carbon dioxide in the air.
Yeah.
Although it's, you know, there's problems with the greenhouse effect because those concentrations are rising. So the plant has these small gas exchange pores in its leaves called stomata.
Yeah.
And the plant has to be careful about when it opens these stomata, because while the stomata opens, it gets carbon dioxide, and so it can do its photosynthesis, but it's also losing water.
Yeah.
And so if the water loss reaches a certain level, the plant says, stuff this, I'm in danger of drying out. So I'll close my stomata and I'll end up stopping my photosynthesis.
Sure.
But that's, you know, this is a balancing act that the plant has to almost do this calculation. So with a vine, most grapevines are growing in warm climates. And so grapevines, if it gets too hot, the vine will just shut up shop and won't do any photosynthesis.
What does that mean though? Like if the grapes are ripening,
What grapes need to ripen is the sugar that comes from photosynthesis.
Yeah.
And if it gets hot, the vine will say,
is there
blow
a temperature?
Me down. About 35 degrees.
35.
It gets much above 35, the vine says. And also wind is a factor as well. So basically the loss through evaporation in this transpiration process, which is the way.
Okay. Wind.
If that gets too high, the wind increases that, then the vine will have to shut its stomata. And photosynthesis will stop. And there's this thing called blocage. That's the French term for it. So you get a hot climate like 2003.
Yeah.
And a lot of the 2003 wines, you'd expect them to be super ripe. And there is a lot of fruit sweetness in them. But the tannins are also quite hard on some of them. Because what happened is that the vines, across the large swathes of Europe, found it just too hot.
Yeah.
And they stopped photosynthesizing. And development was actually delayed. And so, paradoxically, in a very hot climate, you end up with poor ripeness in certain areas. You know, you get some bits of ripeness, but you don't get the other bits. So the grapes aren't very good.
I was talking to your mate Sam Harrop when I was at the IWC, and he was talking about South African wines quite often having a sort of a greeny tinge to them.
Yeah.
And he was describing that as maybe it was getting too hot.
Yeah.
And so, but that seemed to imply that the fruit development, flavor development stopped as well as maybe what you're saying, the tannins stop as well.
Yeah, I think it's. I don't know the exact, precise technical details. I don't know if it's been researched about what happens to the different flavor components. But you can end up with unripeness,
even in a very hot climate.
You can end up with an alcoholic wine that's quite sweetly fruited, but it has some aspects of unripeness to it as well.
So is the sugar being? But the sugar stops when photosynthesis stops.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how does the sugar keep building up?
Well, the sugar will build up anyway, but you'll find that something goes out of kilter with these varying sort of like ripeness curves. If you think about the curves of ripeness, you want them to intersect the right place. And the different elements of ripeness in grapes all have different parameters controlling them, such that you could end up in a situation where you've got some aspects of ripeness are fine and other aspects are delayed.
Yeah. Okay, so the plant gets too hot.
Yeah.
It shuts down the
stomata
and it stops or slows down photosynthesis significantly to deal with the situation. Does it just decide to wait until it gets warmer, cooler again, or does it do other respiratory processes? I've heard that it starts absorbing acids and things like that sometimes.
Yeah, you can have this process of respiration, which is separate from photosynthesis, whereby basically it's the metabolism of the plant. It's doing its chemical business. You know, its chemical factories are working, and so you can have the plant doing process of respiration separate from the process of photosynthesis. And so you can imagine this all gets quite complex. We can draw all these metabolic pathways, but I just think that's a bit too geeky. But just what the wine grower has to understand is that, you know, the way that these various conditions can impact on the quality of the grapes. And I guess the other thing is to start thinking about management strategies. You know, if you are in a hot climate, to manage your vines in a particular way that you end up getting balanced grapes at the end of it.
What's the respiration process then, if it is different? Because I always associate photosynthesis and respiration almost as a similar type of process.
Well, photosynthesis is a process of taking carbon dioxide and inorganic ions and producing sugars through, you know, in the chloroplast, specialist organelles that have lots of chlorophyll. And there's all these complex metabolic pathways. Basically, light energy is captured, and then that light energy is used to produce sugars.
Okay, what's the respiration?
Respiration uses energy source, such as sugars, to then do some chemistry using inorganic ions and the various building blocks that photosynthesis gives you, which are organic compounds, to then produce the various components of the plant.
Okay, so respiration is not like us, is when we're breathing in and out oxygen and carbon dioxide. It's respiration is actually the process of building the plant.
Yeah, it's the chemical reactions that occur, you know, that independent of photosynthesis, using the photosynthates, then, you know, to do some work with.
I understand if a plant can't get hold of sugars, it uses other things.
Yeah, instead. What it can use other organic compounds. You know, you can break those down. With oxygen present, you know, respiration will use oxygen, and the organic compounds, and you can do chemistry then, basically.
What sort of component does it use instead of sugar? Because somewhere I heard about acids being used, or you see changes in acid levels when the plant stops.
Stored carbohydrates as well, you know, that those you know, that's
the roots.
The roots and all the woody tissues will have carbohydrate stores in them.
Okay.
For instance, at the beginning of the season, you know, the first, you know, those stored carbohydrates are utilized then to produce, you know, the shoots, you know, bud burst. You know, so that the plant can store energy and use that energy, you know, independently of photosynthesis when it's not doing its photosynthesis.
If the plant's not photosynthesizing, what happens to things like, we talked about the flavors developing or not developing, we talked about tannins not ripening.
Yeah.
What about acids? What happens to acids when the plant's not photosynthesizing?
Well, I think the plant can break down acids. So lots of changes can take place without the photosynthesis occurring. I mean, I have to be honest, I don't know the exact chemical pathways that will occur in each situation, independent of photosynthesis or not, in hot climates as opposed to cooler climates. You know, there's a lot of complex chemistry going on in the vine that that personally I just don't have at my fingertips right now. So you put
what
me
do
on
you
the spot,
mean
boy,
you don't have 50 pages of equations rattling off the top of your head?
So I just hope I'm not saying anything really stupid, but you know, not consulting my sources now. So
okay. I suppose the key thing is if the plant's not photosynthesizing, then it's too hot for it to photosynthesize, then everything's going to be out of whack.
Yeah.
Compared to a preferred...
Yeah, I mean, ideally, you want your vines to not experience those big peaks of heat because it's going to cause problems.
Okay, then, Jamie, I'll wrap it up there. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Okie pokey, that ends our... What a great saying that is. Okie pokey. That ends our look at vine biology. I hope I haven't lost too many of you guys in it. It's the sort of thing I like listening to and working out as well, so hopefully you have enjoyed it. Next week, we're on a completely different track. We're going to be finishing up looking at our last two interviews from my trip to Italy. We're going to be talking to a producer in Montepulciano, and then the following week, we're going to be looking at its bigger brother, and probably the more famous, Montecino. But before we finish up, how are you getting on with our mystery grape? If you recall, it was Grenache or Grenache if you're a Spanish person. Here are the clues again. Grenache or Grenache, as it's called in Spain, is a hot climate red variety whose origins are uncertain. As Grenache, it was probably originated in Spain, in Aragon in the north. But it is the same variety grown in Sardinia known as Canonu. So it could have been made the journey from there to Spain when Sardinia was under Aragon rule in 1297 to 1713. Whatever it is, it now has a large presence in France, particularly in the south in Languedoc-Roussillon and southern Rhone. This high-yielding grape variety survives well in such hot, dry, windy vineyards as a result of its strong wood. It buds early and ripens relatively late and can achieve high sugar levels in the regions that afford a long growing cycle. Its weakness or lack of colour and low tannins, which is why it's often blended in Rioja, and normally it's blended with Tempranillo, but it's possible to concentrate both of these characteristics if yields are kept low. Grenache wines tend to oxidise early and have rustic qualities and an attractive sweetness. However, in irrigated vineyards such as the New World, the vine may lose its taste markers. At other extremes, if it's pruned more severely and grown on the poor soil, the vine and grapes reach full maturity, then it can produce red wines needing several decades of cellaring, as some diligent producers of Châteauneuf-du-Pape can show. Grenache certainly is a multi-purpose grape. Apart from producing dry red wines, it also is used to make a rosé in France and in Spain, and is a main ingredient in sweet vin de naturel, such as Bagnols. In California, it produces a misleading named, but rather nice, rosé or white Grenache, while Sardinia makes alcoholic reds and dessert wines from it. Beyond this, it's found grown in Calabria, Sicily, Israel, South and North Africa. Right. Well, it pretty much ends this week's show. Last thing to do is a couple of quotes, and this week it comes from Homer's Odyssey, which is quite an old quote. The wine urges me on, the bewitching wine, which sets even a wise man to singing and to laughing gently, and rouses him up to dance and brings forth words which were better unspoken. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.